So we're on Kaiser Racing Radio number 7, or day 7. Myron, it's kind of like Ben watching paint dry today from the portage across to Unicleet. You can't take your eyes off the tracker, but it's slow going.
So, it is slow going, but there were certainly some developments as the day progressed.
Sure, there were, but I wanted to start first by talking, and I think you'd have really good insight on this. I was looking at the tracker, and in the Iditarod race right now, they have mushers in at least 300 mile string. And logistically, how do they manage that? I mean, you have folks that, I was looking at some bios, and the only thing that the person wants to do is finish the Iditarod, and I get that. But at what point does the race just keep going? Because for example, there's two mushers that have left Galena for Huslia. And it just seems like a kind of a logistical nightmare to have a very exciting front part of the race, but you still have to maintain the rear part of the race.
Well, it is a logistic nightmare. The whole race is, it always is. I have watched it from fairly close a few times, and I'm astounded that they're able to pull it off because the logistics are immense. But I haven't checked this year's rules because I wasn't thinking about that just yet. But they've always had, in recent years, a competitiveness rule saying that if you cease to be competitive, you can be asked to withdraw from the race by the race marshal. And it certainly has happened. I would note for sure that it has happened. I can't tell you the most recent time or the actual details, but there have been mushers that have been asked to leave the race because they were not being competitive. And when they say competitive, I'm not talking about challenging to win or anything, but keeping up a pace that suggests they're racing rather than taking a stroll. Sure. And that doesn't seem all that fair for someone who's gone to all the trouble to get there, but then the other side of the coin is, what must be the logistics of trying to keep a checkpoint open in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a very, very cold winter when you've got volunteers that have other things they need to do, and they're waiting for one or two mushers to come through who may not even need their services, you know, veterinarians, for example. So it's a real problem, and it's a challenge to deal with it in a fair way, and I don't know exactly how they deal with it, what their determination is, but they definitely do have ways of dealing with it.
Right, right. Well, the other thing I wanted to move into from that is that with that 300-mile string, now the mushers are coming into the last 300 or so miles where, you know, the K300 is a 300-mile race that when they show up, they are ready to rock and roll for 300 miles. These folks have 600 miles in the tank. And, you know, how do you prepare for that last bit when, you know, or is it just part of the keep on, keeping on thing? You know, it seemed like that once you get here, you know, things are it's going to get a little bit more exciting because checkpoints are closer and the finish is impending. So, of course, the excitement races up. But to the musher, mentally, how do they deal with that? Do they reset or is it a matter of keep going?
Well, let me first tell you, when I ran the Iditarod, I had never run another race. So when I got to Unicleet, I had nothing to compare to because I hadn't raced the 300-mile race. That our race did not even exist yet. But in later years, when I would see teams get to Unicleet and I would see their situation, then it was very possible for me to visualize what they must be thinking, because I can tell you that racing the 300 has mental and physical challenges all of its own. Those 300 miles can get long, especially if the weather's bad or if the team is not going well. And the prospect of doing that when you've already been beat up, and this year I would say, beat up pretty badly by the weather. It must be daunting for those guys. And it's hard for me to imagine
right.
what a team struggling along way at the back must think when they've done two or three races of shorter distance. They get to the coast, the weather's been bad, their traveling has not been easy, they're exhausted, and somebody says, oh, we just got 300 miles to go. That would be very difficult to say, oh boy, we're almost there, because you're not almost there.
Well, and we've seen, just today, we've seen another example, but we've seen real veteran mushers kind of break down in the trail. I mean, Martin Boozer was, you know, he was very, I won't say melodramatic, but he was in the middle of the trail, self-reflective. I don't know, you know, it was obvious that he was being challenged mentally. And then today we had Jeff leaving Caltag saying he was ready to unleash the dragon. And then 50 miles down the road, the magic is gone. So, I mean, it must be, you know, I can never imagine, you can, of course, but there's a mental challenge for the mushers that sometimes I don't think it's, you think mostly about the dogs pulling the team, but I think there's, don't you think there's a lot to that challenge for the musher?
Oh, really? Poorer sleep this year than normal. Because of the cold, very difficult to catch a nap on the trail. And then just the cold making every task harder. And when I say harder, I mean lots harder. Taking care of dogs when it's 20 above is a snap compared to when it's 20 below. And when you get down to 40 below, it becomes a challenge just to get it done. Because there's so many things you have to think of to do in a just correct way. Or don't work at all. Things just do not work if you don't perform correctly at 40 below. And the challenge facing those racers is immense when it gets that cold.
Right. And you know, I guess what it opened my eyes, because you have here two guys that are multiple winners, done it many, many times, and they're facing some tough times. These younger guys, I mean, maybe it's easier on the younger guy, but there's a bunch of guys that may not be prepared for that when they're on the trail as well. So there has been some developments. Why don't you talk about today? It's been Aaron first into the checkpoint in 11 hours, which wasn't bad. I looked through some of the historicals, and that's not a bad time.
No, he went straight through, of course, because he had an 8-hour rest just before he left. I don't know his plan, but I suspect he's exactly on his plan in terms of rest and run. I'm pretty sure he planned on 8 hours there from the very start and then planned on running all the way through. And he came in first place. Now, the developments that I see are that we seem to be down to a three-team race now for first place. Aaron and Ali Zirkel and Dallas Seavey, and the reason I discount the two that I had in there previously, that would be Mitch Seavey and Jeff King. Jeff King clearly faltered on the way across today, and that's in keeping with what happened to him in this same stretch of race a couple of years ago, and I'm told, I don't know if this is a fact, I'm told that he has a couple of the same leaders on the team that faltered there a couple of years ago, so that would not be an entirely unusual event for that to happen again, especially if they're tired. Now, Jeff has run long runs ever since coming into Galena, when he passed up Ruby to get into Galena for a 24-hour, and it had served him well to make a little, give him a little edge. But now it's apparently coming back at him because he has faltered, and I do not think he's among the top three contenders right now.
Yeah. But the one that I think that should be in that list, and of course I'd love to say Pete and Jor, but Jessie Royer is really still, I mean, she's just right out of the picture.
Those three, all three still have a shot. And the shot they have is the same kind of shot I spoke of yesterday. anyone on the front that falters, if these teams keep up their speed and their lively means of getting down the trail, they will cause trouble for anybody who falters. And I think the two that have faltered today, Mitch and Jeff, are going to get passed by one or more of those three. And so that puts one or more of those three in the top five. And maybe all three of them are candidates for that, because there's not a whole lot to pick from between those three that you just mentioned. Now, will teams in the top three falter? Well, they can force themselves to falter. And here's how that works. If they are so focused on winning that they copy each other's moves, in other words, they are governed by what's going on around them, and somebody makes a move that they shouldn't make, and the others two copy them to keep up, they could falter. And if they do that, then these teams that are chomping at the bit right behind them could move in. So it's not over. I'm just saying that the top three have the best position
right
now, because based on their speed and their experience and all the stuff that works into deciding who's going to win. And, of course, among those, Dallas has the edge because of his speed. But let me explain how speed can be eliminated as a factor, too. Many teams are comfortable running at a high speed. I have heard reports from this race that Dallas stops frequently to maintain his speed. And that's always a good idea. If you've got a high-moving, fast-moving team, you want to keep that speed as long as possible. And there are two ways that speed will eventually come down. One, very gradually, which is, I guess, the preferred method. If you got a dog team, you don't want them to lose their speed quickly, or dramatically. And I will give you the best example I can from the old days. The guy that used to be a real speedy musher was Herbie Knapke. And when his team was going well, they were very hard to keep up with for anybody. But as soon as they decided they were not going to travel that speed anymore, they shifted into low speed. They went from very fast to very slow. And if there was enough distance left in the race, he was in trouble, because an average team could pass the slow-moving Herbie Knapke team. And so that's how Dallas could lose some of his speed. If he is forced into a situation where he can no longer stop frequently because these two teams running with him stay on the trail steady, then he may find himself going much slower all of a sudden. If that happens, then either of those other two teams have been successful, and they, as long as they can stay on the trail, they should have a chance to stay ahead. But that all plays out here in the next couple of days.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because it was something I was wondering about. So when you don't take, how often do you stop to do you stop to make water, or do you have water that you whip out really quickly? You're saying that Dallas stops frequently. Is that for just a quick 5-10 minutes, or explain how that all works when you're running 80
miles?
Well,
there's a lot of different ways of doing it. From the looks of watching Dallas's plan this year, he likes to stop for 3-4 hours. And he likes to do that every 4 or 5 hours. And those numbers may not be precise, but he hasn't been pulling off any 8-hour runs or 10-hour runs like some are.
Right, but I mean, so Aaron, for example, was he able to stop and water his dogs along the way?
I don't know exactly what he was doing, but you don't go from Caltech to Uniclay without feeding and watering your dogs. There's no question that you would do that. However, each musher develops their own system for getting food and water in a team while they're moving on a long run. And it's a 10-minute break. I saw some of those 10-minute breaks on the tracker today. It shows their speed at 2.3 or something. And then the next one shows at 3.4. Well, that means for about 10 minutes in the middle of those beeps, they were stopped. excuse me. And during that stop, they threw them something, some kind of a snack that had enough moisture in it to keep them going.
Sure.
When I raced, I always carried very wet snacks to throw to them so that they were getting plenty of moisture.
Right. Right. And so when you head out for the trail, you have to end up prepping for the meal at hand. But what you're saying is you must have to deal with what you think you're going to need to take for that next leg then.
Right. And that has to be safely stored so it doesn't freeze up. And it's, at 40 below, that's a challenge.
Right. Well, between Unicleat and the finish, where do you see the biggest places to make a mistake, given the way it is right now? I mean, they're going to have a lot of wind, but it looks like visibility is still good.
Okay, well, the obvious first hurdle is Shaktuik to Koyak. That's a tough one against a big wind, and it looks like it's straight out of the north at Koyak, from what I saw.
Yep, it sure is, and it's supposed to increase over the night.
Right. So that's the obvious one. If you get stuck out there and for some reason can't go forward or go forward at a greatly reduced pace and take way longer than you planned, that could be a major problem for somebody. I can assure you it would have to be huge winds to keep somebody from not trying to go across. But, because they've been crossing that thing in some god-awful winds in the last few years. But nonetheless, it can be a problem area. If things get too grim out there, it can really mess up a team.
Well, what about the, for Aaron's team, for example, these teams that went through some of that, they have a history with wind. Will they reject the wind, or does that make them, when you have, like you were talking about the King's leaders, that those are the ones that kind of decided they didn't want to go. When you have a team that's experienced something dramatic, do you have to train that out of them so that for the last year that, you've trained out of them so that you don't have to deal with it, hopefully, or do you just...
Well, that would certainly be the goal, is if you've had a team that's had a very bad experience, you got to figure out a way to confront that experience and hopefully convince the dogs that it's not something to fear in the future, because there have been all kinds of tales. I've experienced a couple of them myself of dogs balking at exactly the spot where something bad happened to them earlier, and it can be ugly.
Right, right. Well, it looks like the thing is heating up, and I think tomorrow this time they should be. There's no other layovers till White Mountain, so we're going to be talking about how windy it was and the Koyak thing. It'll be a lot of fun to watch. Today was a little slow. I see a lot of folks. Hugh Neff said on the Insider, I believe, that was the coldest he'd been. He was tired of the cold coming into Caltag this morning. So I guess that was something I didn't really understand when I was writing, that I knew it was cold, but I didn't know it was that cold, and everybody's been talking about it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it was a special kind of cold. Sometimes it had to do with relative humidity, too, and since there is a little bit of storm coming, the humidity maybe went up some, and that can make that feel all the much colder.
Right. Well, now it's not that much better, because now they've gone to 3 above, and now they've got 20 knots of wind, so they're just now it's in your face, and now they're going to turn right into the wind as they go up the coast, so it's going to be interesting. All right, Myron, well, thanks a lot. It was another fun conversation, and we'll see how it looks tomorrow.
You bet.
All right.